Good afternoon, good evening, good morning to all of our viewers and listeners. Welcome to DD Geopolitics. I'm your host today, Christopher, and I'm joined by the wonderful, beautiful, and brilliant co-host of DD Geopolitics, Sarah. Hi. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm back from an epic four-day adventure and a very, very good fact-finding and journalistic trip to Kursk. As everyone knows, in August of last year, Kursk was invaded by Ukrainian regime forces, which occupied a sizable part of the southern part of the oblast. And thanks to an amazing counteroffensive launched by the Russian armed forces, they were eventually pushed out this year. But of course, the damage was unbelievable and extensive. The human cost and in lives, especially the targeting of civilians, was unconscionable and quite barbaric and horrific. And we'll talk about that when we get to the section of this episode about my trip. But first and foremost, lots going on in the world, as always. There's no lack of news for everyone out there, as I'm sure you all are well aware. And we'll start today's episodes with the nuclear brinksmanship, which is back again. We are back. It's like we're in a time machine, except nobody's crawling under desks because everyone knows now that desks won't do a damn thing. So at this point, just, you know, kiss your ass goodbye, because if those things start flying, I don't know, no bunker is really going to save you. So let's start by looking at, I'm looking here for our videos. Maybe you can help me with these media assets here.
Okay, I can do that.
I have no clue how to do this.
Which one do you want?
The Minuteman III ICBM, if we have it.
Right there.
There it is. There it is in all of its glory. So the U.S. conducted a test launch of an unarmed Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, according to the U.S. Space Force. I actually, you know what? I'm still trained to call it Vandenberg Air Force Base, but I think it's a Space Force base now. But in any case, it is one of the most important sites on the West Coast for the placement of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Of course, for those who know, the Minuteman III system is old and aging, you know, which is why there have been all sorts of calls for upgrading the missile itself and to adopt new missiles. The missile flew about 4,200 miles to the Reagan test site in the Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands. So officials said the drills were part of a routine, checks and readiness. And of course, the U.S. Said that the test confirmed the reliability and readiness of the U.S. nuclear systems. It has also been reported that the U.S. informed the Russian Federation ahead of these tests so that they were well aware. Well, of course, as we'll see, the ongoing discussions about whether we will commence with nuclear testing. What does that even look like? Is it going to be in a lab? Are we going to start dropping bombs in Nevada again? Are we going to do atmospheric tests? Are we going to go under the water like in Bikini Atoll? What kind of testing are we talking about here? Are we doing AI testing? Is this just going to be for the fun of it? So we have another video here coming out of the Russian Security Council meeting, because, of course, the Russians are taking the discussion of nuclear testing resumption by the Trump administration seriously. So let's take a listen here.
Хочу отметить, что Россия всегда неукоснительно придерживалась и придерживается обязательств по договору о всеобъемлющем запрещении ядерных испытаний и планов отойти от этих обязательств у нас нет. Вместе с тем, действительно, еще в послании Федеральному собранию в 2023 году мне было сказано, что в случае, если Соединенные Штаты либо другие государства, участники соответствующего договора, проведут такие испытания, то и Россия тоже должна будет соответствующим образом предпринять адекватные ответные действия. В этой связи я поручаю Министерству иностранных дел, Министерству обороны Российской Федерации, специальным службам и гражданским ведомствам, соответствующим гражданским ведомствам, сделать все для того, чтобы собрать дополнительную информацию по этому вопросу, провести ее анализ на площадке Совета Безопасности и внести согласованные предложения о возможном начале работ по подготовке испытаний ядерного оружия.
So there you have it. There you have it. Of course, the Kremlin was very quick to say that this was a conversation about the possible the possibility of whether even nuclear tests could be resumed. Of course, nuclear testing was done in the Far East, also in Central Asia. Some of that territory no longer belongs to the Russian Federation, what once was the Soviet Union. Now it's Kazakhstan and other places where test sites were located. So, of course, I'm sure there's going to be investigations. The main thing is that Russian Defense Minister Andrei Belousov was quick to point out that the United States is aggressively modernizing and accelerating that modernization of its strategic offensive weapons, which is of great concern. Of course, we can joke and have fun about the Golden Dome. Say, America loves golden stuff, golden showers, golden domes, golden... No, but it's true. This is the reality here. So when you look at this, I mean, you have to think about, you know, the fact that the United States is very much thinking about this as sort of like a state of the art, massive system that's going to destroy both Russia and China and these kinds of things. And of course, Minister of Defense Belousov was quick to point out four key elements here. Number one is the end of arms control, because a lot of the arms agreements have lapsed now at this point. They weren't necessarily renewed under the Biden administration, which was a very bizarre time period in terms of U.S.-Russia relations. There were basically no relations. So that was the end of some of the arms control agreements. Now there's a question of whether there will be a continuation of some of the aging arms agreements, which have not been renewed, and people are wondering if they're going to be renewed. And they're becoming sort of like the congressional budget every year. Like, maybe we'll extend it for a year and then see. We'll extend it for another year and then see. And it's like, okay, well, can't we just do these things in 10 years or 20 years? But nobody's operating in that capacity anymore. The second thing, of course, is the Dark Eagle missile deployment. Will you remember, for those of you who are old enough to remember the red balloons and all this stuff, all of the counter missile protests that took place in Germany because of the deployment of missiles. I'm trying to remember the name of the missile. It's going to come back to me. It's going to come back to me in the middle of the show. But there was a missile system that was deployed in Germany that was at the source of a lot of the tension in the 80s. And so people were deeply concerned about missile deployment in Europe because it put Europe at the front line of a possible nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. So, okay, now the United States is back at it. And there's talk of deploying the Dark Eagle missile systems, which is a hypersonic missile. It's one of the newer weapon systems in the U.S. arsenal. And they're talking about deploying it. It can reach central Russia in between 6-7 minutes or so, which, of course, I mean, when you think about that, 6-7 minutes, by the time the missile launches, you have confirmation of the missile launch, you inform command, strategic commands are given. I mean, there's basically, well, what time is left? So this is a great concern to the Russian Federation. The third thing was the preparation of nuclear tests, which we've discussed, of course. And that's a really, really important aspect of this whole conversation. Of course, we'll get to who responded. We are always waiting for our favorite to respond to the possibility of these tests. And, of course, the readiness of different Russian arms now. We've seen Russia testing a variety of weapon systems that have not been loaded. They've been just the missile systems themselves, testing underwater systems, airborne systems, ground-based systems. So we have a whole new arsenal. In fact, it has now been, I would say, almost confirmed by the entire sort of think tank community that Russia's capabilities now have outpaced even the United States in some areas. So Russia now has the most advanced nuclear triad system in the world. That triad system, of course, includes waterborne vehicles and submersibles. So we're talking about submarines here, right? We're talking about airborne assets. So your bombers, your planes, and of course, the land-based missiles. So that's what we're looking at there. Of course, we had a response fairly quickly after that. I'm looking for the tweet again from our beloved Medvedev, who was quick to point out that Trump, here we are. He wrote, and I quote, "No one knows what Trump meant about nuclear testing. He probably doesn't himself. But he's the president of the United States, and the consequences of such words are inescapable. Russia will be forced to assess the expediency of conducting full-fledged nuclear tests itself." So we're back. We're back at it. We're back at it. I always think about Fukuyama and what he's thinking about these days, because he's holed up somewhere in some think tank or academic institution in the U.S., I'm sure. And what is he thinking about? We're back at it, you know? Is a champagne toast? We're a bit premature. What do you think?
Well, I have a few questions then. Do you think that, because we went from Trump saying he wanted to decrease nuclear arms, and I took that as a sign that, back then I took it as a sign, our nuclear arsenal needs a lot of updates, a lot of very expensive updates that we probably can't afford. So a way of being like, let's tone down our arsenals is a way of, you know, kind of dissipating those sort of costs. That's what I thought. Now I'm wondering, was it a bluff the whole time? Because you just said that the United States has been building up the arsenal this whole time.
They have, and they have been doing it secretly in many ways. Actually, the Russian Federation called out the United States. I believe China did as well some years ago. It was during Trump's first administration where there was talk of tactical nuclear weapon production modifications, which actually violated some of the strategic arms control agreements. And the Trump administration was like, there was this whole back and forth about it. And eventually, these strategic arms control agreements have lapsed. And now Russia's like, well, if the U.S. is doing it, we have to do it. I mean, this is the whole point of parity and having that capability to balance, you know, your opponent or at least your strategic adversary. So in this case, the Trump administration, actually all of the administrations have been actively and secretly promoting new technologies and updating the missile systems and the warheads themselves all along. They just haven't been open and transparent about it.
I do have that clip of Putin discussing the weapons.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Уважаемые друзья, наша страна никому не угрожает. Россия, как и все другие ядерные державы, развивает свой ядерный потенциал, развивает свой стратегический потенциал. Все, о чем мы сейчас говорим, это давно анонсированная работа. Все наши планы по созданию перспективных систем вооружения, по развитию оборонно-промышленного комплекса, по обеспечению армии и флота России современной техникой и вооружениями выполняются. Имею в виду создание и поставку на боевое дежурство новейшего ракетного комплекса стратегического назначения «Авангард». Мы создали и поставили на дежурство, приступили к серийному производству ракетного комплекса средней дальности «Орешник». Оснастили наши межконтинентальные баллистические ракеты и ракеты подводных лодок современными комплексами средств преодоления противоракетной обороны. А вот в текущем году поставим на опытно-боевое, в следующем уже на боевое дежурство системы с тяжелой межконтинентальной ракетой «Сармат».
Serial production of Oreshnik and Sarmat.
And they're coming online for battlefield testing. So here we go. I hope Zelensky has a big enough bunker.
I don't want to be in another arms race. You guys got to get me out of here before we get into an arms race with Russia.
I'm ready. I got to pull out couch here ready for you. We're ready to go.
We're ready to go. Me and my dog. Well, there was other tests, and I guess the United States got a front row seat to them. Here's Putin at the same talk or at the same speech, and this is what he had to say.
По дальности полета «Буревестник», как известно, превзошел все известные в мире ракетные системы. У него высокая точность поражения цели, которую он четко, уверенно достигает в заранее рассчитанное время. Но, думаю, убедиться в этом смогли и зарубежные специалисты, поскольку в зоне и во время проведения испытаний «Буревестника» 21 октября постоянно находился НАТОвский разведывательный корабль. Мы не мешали его работе. Пусть посмотрят.
Let them watch. Let them watch.
Let them watch, you cucks.
You cucks, that's it.
Get, sit in the cuck chair and watch this missile test Borevestnik.
No, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. And There's no doubt that if the United States doesn't pull back its support for Ukraine and might increase its support, depending, we could really enter a period of a full-fledged arms race. We really could. We're there basically, but we're not full-fledged arms race. We're like low. I would say like a low intensity arms race. Everybody's updating their technologies, but not at the level of at the time of the Soviet Union, where like vast sums of money were being spent comparable to money for other things. Of course, the US defense, or not defense budget, war budget now is at over $1 trillion. So, I mean, we are there in for all intents and purposes. We're going from low intensity to very high intensity very quick. So what do you think about, like, what do you think the next few years look like in terms of the relationship with, do you have any rosy-colored glasses like Kirill Dmitriev, or are you more on the middle?
I really dislike Kirill Dmitriev. I think he serves a purpose, but he's like the QAnon of that whole, of the, like, Putin's circle. Like, he's literally like QAnon. He really does believe in a lot of the QAnon stuff. And he met with Anna Paulina Luna. So right when he did that, I was like, okay, he's serving a purpose. But no, I'm the opposite. I had a better outlook before. I even thought that things might have been okay after Alaska. But after Alaska, things have steadily gone downhill. We still don't know what happened in Alaska. And I think that the relations have deteriorated and continue to do so. And the Russians are being very stoic about it. And the Americans are kind of being like very pouty. We talked to Putin and then he bombs anyway. And you know, I think the relations are actually getting worse.
I think so too. I really think that Trump thought that he could strong arm Russia in the same way that he might strong arm other world leaders to kind of like do the deal as a favor to me and I'll like open up business. Yeah. And I really believe, because Putin and his circle, and I think the entire leadership of the Russian Federation are like, we cannot just do this for you. We really have to address the root issues here, because otherwise we're going to send another couple hundred thousand soldiers to go and fight in the next war that comes, because the root causes haven't been, the root issues haven't been.
And that's a pattern of behavior with the Americans. And we're going to talk about it a little bit later in the episode about more root causes. They always want to address the symptoms or the things that you can see. They never want to actually, because getting down to what actually caused it, it requires introspection. It requires an assumption of some of the guilt. The United States is very much responsible for the war in Ukraine. And they have been responsible for Ukraine's movement toward or anti-Russian sentiment for the last 70 years. So yeah, to get to the root causes of it would be required to admit fault or some responsibility. And the United States will never do that, especially not the Trump administration.
No way.
You know, their whole thing is, I didn't start any of these wars. And it's like our policy that you carried on through the, your, at least your first term, did help start these wars.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think we are headed into a much more volatile point in the world system at this point. I don't necessarily think that we're going to have any stability, because compounding this issue, or maybe you could even say underlying issues that have really led to this moment, are the decline of the U.S. as a power, the rise sort of that multipolar world, but that void that exists between that transformation is at the root of this issue. And I don't think the U.S. wants to give up that easy. You know, it's sort of that poem. I'm trying to remember the exact phrasing, but sort of like, basically fight the night, you know, fight as you're like dying.
Do not go into that gentle night.
Yes.
Fight against the dying of the light.
There you go. See, that's why you're the poet. And
you're the Iranian. I'm the less literary one.
It's true. I'm also sleep deprived from 4 days on the road.
4 days of traveling.
But I would say, like, it reminds me that the U.S. will not go quietly into the night.
No.
At all.
They're kicking and screaming.
Yeah, I'm kicking and screaming or launching missiles.
Bombing, yeah. Kicking and screaming, launching missiles and bombing. And you're right. He's kind of... Oh, rage. That's right. Rage against the dying of the light. Sorry.
That's rage. That's rage.
Sorry, but thank you. He's kind of struck out, like three strikes. He struck out with Modi. That was probably the weakest of the three that he probably could have pushed around. Obviously, Iran was bombed. But the weakest of the three, Modi said, I'm not going to have it. Went to Putin. Putin said, I'm not going to have it unless you address the root causes of this. And then he was like, well, last ditch effort, I'm going to go to Xi.
And then he was like,
very lukewarm. That's being generous. I just think that people are very turned off. And that's like the only way I can think of describing it. Just like, I don't know. I just think that he has struck out with everybody. There was no win in China. No win in Russia, no win with India either.
I agree with you. I think if you think, you remember that picture of Xi, Putin, and Modi together? That picture from, I think it was the Shanghai?
Yeah, SCO. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And when they were together, you know how I think about this picture? These are three civilization states of like the oldest variety. I mean, two of them are actual like ancient civilizations.
Yeah.
Sense of, you know,
yeah, China and India. Yeah.
China 5,000, and you have Indus Valley, India back in the day, another plus 5,000 year civilization. Russia, of course, over 1,000 years in terms of the Rus themselves. And then before that, of course, all the other inhabitants, and really for some, the real origin of the spread of humanity, especially in Eurasia. But if you think about those three leaders, they're saying, okay, the new kid on the block is having a fit.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that the new kid is eventually going to pout and might even, you know, just leave the game altogether or just implode and get taken out. And so I think that they're sitting there. I mean, one has to recognize that these three leaders, they're not stupid. They read history. They read books. They are very well educated. And it's not rocket science to read from different professors and thinkers that we also like and admire that are basically saying the U.S. is either in collapse or on the precipice of collapse or a declining power. And so therefore you just, you know, sit back and say, what's the rush? What are you rushing for? You know, and that's what we see. We see a level of, if you were to think about it, we see a strategic patience that might also be a strategic patience to see what happens internally in the U.S. and to kind of keep looking at the U.S. as a power that's on the edge, on the rocks, having its own internal dynamics. And of course, they won't interfere, but they're just like, maybe now's not the right time, you know, to deal with you in this way.
It's a shame I don't still have the Victor Gal clip where she says, "You're going to lose America." And he goes, "We don't care. We don't care. China has been here for 5,000 years. There's most of the time there was no United States. It's the greatest clip ever." And he says, "And if there is no United States, we expect to survive another 5,000 years. It's just the greatest. It's the greatest clip. It's so fantastic. I play it constantly in the MAGA spaces. No, I'm not racist. I just love Victor Galloway. He says, "We don't care." Like, he's like very assertive.
I love
yelling at the British interviewer. Oh, I love Victor Gal so much. But yeah, you're right. And you
said
these are smart leaders. We are so out of our league with these people. Like, we're talking about like mayors in China have PhDs, like in engineering. Like,
Putin
has written dissertations. Modi is a PhD. Like, this guy got a MBA from Wharton because he's like rich. Like, what are we doing? Like, what are, like, Lavrov went, I think he went to MIGMO, and he's dealing with who? Rubio? Like, really? Could you imagine putting Pete Hegseth and Belousov in a room together? Would you insult him that way?
Belousov, and first of all, Belousov comes from a very like distinguished academic family. His dad was an amazing professor as well. I just can't imagine that.
It's they're playing two different games. And I think a lot of it is like, why don't we just wait until America wears themselves out? Like, this isn't sustainable.
You know, it's funny because I would always ask my students about, like, just as an aside, because you brought it up now, I think it's an important point. The kind of stereotypes, like people, when they think of stereotypes, I'm like, okay, what's your stereotype of a Russian woman? And they're like, I don't know, KGB agent, prostitute, who knows what? What's your stereotype of a Russian man, like a gangster, sort of like drunk. A mafioso, a drunk? And then nobody ever thinks to ever like sits down and thinks like, wait a minute. Like, they had an empress, they had, you know, Tsar Catherine the Great, they had fucking Pushkin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, you know, they had Shostakovich, Tchaikovsky. I mean, they had all these greats, all these enormous thinkers, Chekhov, you name it. And the thing is that Russia actually is an extremely intellectual society. Also because of the language complexity. And it's far more complex and rich than English. That's for damn sure. I think that people love to read. I see people opening up books everywhere and reading. There's such a culture of reading and like literature here. And people writing books. And people writing articles for just for fun. And people were like writing their memoirs. Everybody writes their memoirs here. Like, the life of a seamstress. And I'm like, that looks interesting. And somehow everybody has like some amazing stories. Like, okay, life of a seamstress. But I like sewed like, you know, 50,000 pairs of socks for the Great Patriotic War.
Yeah,
and Hero of labor, you know, something like that. That's what it's like here. And just the perception that the U.S. is seen here. I mean, they're really a bunch of cowboys, really a bunch of, like, they always consider them kind of like more brutish and not as refined, not as, you know, more on the edge in terms of people. I just like to see that it's like the reverse in the U.S. conception. But of course, you know, the facts remain that these three countries, these three civilizations are very learned and very wise. And they know a thing. They've been on the block a while. So they know a thing or two about a young power coming up and a little bit too big for its own good, and they just buy their time. They got a lot of it, you know.
Well, speaking of doing things for the Great Patriotic War, we couldn't tell our viewers on Sunday while you were there, but you were just in Kursk.
There I am.
There you are.
Yeah, so as you can see, so this was, we took this picture there because all the other signs on the way down had disappeared for the most part or were blown apart. So we took one here at least to give people an idea. So as you saw, we're at 48 kilometers to Suja. We went right outside of Suja. And then, of course, Sumy, in, you know, is, you know, way down below, you know, on the other side. So you saw, of course, that in this part, people were not expecting last year for a Ukrainian Of course, this area had been bombed. This area had been subject to drone attacks and things like that. But the Ukrainian armed forces entered the territory of the Russian Federation, entering into the Kursk Oblast, and started to take over villages all up and down the line. Now, there's a lot of stories. I have a lot of material. Of 4 days, I filled up a whole notebook of writing. I interviewed about 30 people, and I'm talking full-fledged interviews. And I had a great opportunity to interview Ukrainian prisoners of war. So just to give people an idea, there I am with one of the Ukrainian prisoners of war. I'm going to put pseudonyms on all of them because, of course, their situation is a bit complex. Many of them still have family members in Ukraine, and it's a very difficult situation for them. But all but two of the Ukrainian prisoners of war were forcibly mobilized. They didn't want to fight.
And you said you interviewed 11, right?
Yeah, but I talked to, there were much more. There were about 30 of them there.
So two out of 30 were volunteers.
Yes, were volunteers of that group. Because in the buildup, to this operation, of course, they took a lot of, they forcibly mobilized a lot of people from Sumy region, from the surrounding areas, all the way down to like Poltava, all the way through to Kiev, like that whole region. Mm-hmm. They just forcibly mobilized a bunch of people, brought them over there, trained them. And by the way, some of them were trained. There were two of them trained in Britain. One of them trained in France. And the stories are amazing. But how they crossed the borders and how they got on planes that were unmarked and how they traveled to other European countries to train with Western officers teaching them with Ukrainian civilian translators. I mean, there is so much stuff. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Exclusive.
Oh, it's going to be exclusive. It's about 8 hours of footage.
That's insane. I'm really intrigued about those sort of back channels and the connection to the Western governments and Western countries is how like they're exchanging like these. Like, I think people think proxy war and you just kind of give them guns and that's what proxy war means. And it's like, no, we're like in the war. We're very much involved in the war.
Every single volunteer that was there, because I see a question in the chat, had the two volunteers change their mind? Every single person who I interviewed and who I talked to changed their mind because they said that they had never heard the other side and there was so much propaganda and they were forced to believe so many things that they all, not only had they come to the Russian position, and by the way, a lot of them have family in Russia. Of course, these regions these borders are not fixed. I mean, before it was the Soviet Union, then it was the Russian Empire. I mean, people's families are on both sides. So people were like, I didn't speak to my family since 2014. But then when I was, and I got to first preface this by saying when the Ukrainians were captured, they were treated humanely. They were fed. Russians asked them. And by the way, they all spoke Russian. Nobody's really speaking Ukrainian. Like everything was in Russian. Everybody communicates in Russian. This is one of the other things about this whole scenario is that what is this Ukrainian language?
You're like capturing your own people.
Right. So the Russians took care of them, provided them. They provided them with food, medicine, water and any other liquids that they needed for their health, like for example IV drips, things like that, and they allowed them to make phone calls to contact their family members and to inform other people's family members if they had lost people in their unit. Why? Because when the Ukrainian military sends troops to storm, they issue missing notices immediately while they're still alive to their family members. That's what we were told. We were told that at the moment that you go to storm, which is basically to the frontal assault, the Ukrainian military instantly issues missing notices for everyone in that unit, even if they're still alive. So a lot of the family members had received missing notices already and thought they were dead. They thought it was prank calls. They didn't even know they were real, that they were alive. So it was shocking to hear that. What was even more shocking was the rampant abuse within the Ukrainian military. People were tortured. People were hazed. There was substandard training. It basically was, there was free booze. You could get drugs at a price. Everything was inflated in terms of cost, of which people's salaries were stolen by their commanding officers.
That's been rampant.
Yeah. So there were just a lot of stories like this. Of the Ukrainian POWs I spoke with, two had been criminally charged by the Russian Federation for executing a Russian soldier. And they admitted to it. The guy was on the verge of tears. I really went in depth to this and really, you know, interview. And he was crying and, you know, he was so emotional. Tears started coming down. We had to cut. But he had found, he was a commander of this small squad and he had found a wounded Russian. So he called back to his headquarters and said, we have a wounded Russian here. You know, can we help them? Can we give medical aid? Can we bring him back? And the command was to shoot him. And it was a woman commander, by the way. It was a woman commander who gave the order, no one is to be left alive.
Where did the majority of the guys that you interviewed, where had they seen, like, where, what fronts were they primarily on?
A lot of them, only the two of them who had volunteered before had seen action, for example, in Donetsk, or had seen action since 2022. The vast majority, this was their first or second battle in total. They literally were thrown into the meat grinder.
In Kursk.
When they found out that they were going to Sumy, they knew immediately where they were going. And they said, this is like, people tried to escape. People were shot at for escaping and things like that. And when they went, a few of them mentioned that when their commanders weren't even looking, they fled to the Russian lines. They literally dropped their guns and started running to them with their hands up. They didn't want to die. They didn't want to die for Zelensky and his regime. They didn't even believe in it anymore. They were forcibly mobilized. So listening to that was truly eye-opening and heart-wrenching, of course. A lot of these guys, you can tell, a lot of them, for the short time on the battlefield, they saw a lot of things. Some of them were wounded. You could tell some of them had battle scars and things like that. But it was unbelievable to listen to that. I then interviewed civilians. I interviewed civilians, and the civilian stories were very heart-wrenching. Executions of civilians, murder of children, forced rapes, the plundering of all the valuables, you know.
Like World War II. Like, this is like war. This is like
war. Oh, yeah. I mean, the civilians I talked to, you could totally tell. And I've been to war. I've seen people who survived war. My family members survived war. You could totally tell that especially the younger kids were absolutely traumatized. Absolutely traumatized. I didn't ask some questions because I didn't want to re-traumatize them, even though I wanted to ask the parents. But you could tell, like, the fidgeting, the not being able to do eye contact, the absolute silence, the sort of biting of the lips, you know, things like that. They were traumatized. But something very interesting from this experience, the civilians were adamant that the first wave of Ukrainians were the best. They were the ones who were forcibly mobilized.
Okay.
And so they told them to flee. They were not nationalists at all.
Yeah,
they said Ukrainians, like, loved us and said, please flee. I have families. Find my family members in these villages. Find my aunt, uncle, aunt, cousins. And flee, because they said the people behind us will have no mercy. And who came behind? The nationalists.
Azov.
And all those guys, the people from Pravdi sector before. Mm-hmm. And behind them came the worst of the worst.
The tornado types.
Foreign mercenaries.
Yeah.
The most brutal atrocities committed in the Kursk Oblast that we have now documented and others have documented were committed by Polish foreign mercenaries, Georgian foreign mercenaries, French foreign mercenaries, American foreign mercenaries, and Colombian.
Colombian, yeah, big time.
They said they strung people up, butchered people, tortured people, horrific things. Burned people in their cars, burned people in their houses, barricaded people in and threw grenades. I mean, the type of stuff that was being said was, I mean, it reminded me of my time in Syria and what we saw Daesh doing. I mean, this is that kind of level of atrocity.
Well, I mean, they have worked together. They've trained together. Yes. The same forces in Syria have trained with Ukrainians.
Of course, of course. There were, as somebody mentions, you forgot, there are British mercenaries, and some people heard English, but they said that they were Americans. Of course, you are a villager in you're either living in Suja or in the surrounding villages. You don't know, but the people who were able to recount stories recounted the certain mercenaries that they encountered. But certainly there are British mercenaries, there are Mexican mercenaries, there are all sorts of mercenaries out there. But these were the ones that were recounted to me. It was truly, truly heart-wrenching. And then we went. So then the next day, we got the permission from the authorities. We had no idea where we were going. So we went near, right outside of Suja, to a village where I have video clips and things like that. And it was unbelievable, the damage. The damage to civilian infrastructure, the damage from drones. You could tell that there was a lot of fighting in this area. This was like Zelensky's most important counterattack. Now, I did not fully understand what the objective of the Kursk offensive was until I got there and somebody just happenstance said, "Oh, do you see those lights over there?" And I was like, "Yeah, in the distance. That's the Kurchatov nuclear power plant." And I was like, that's a nuclear
power. Oh, yeah, they were there to take the plant. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, people had talked about it, but everybody said that the objective was to take the plant as a bargaining chip. But most of all, the nationalists wanted to do a Chernobyl-type event, or worse, on the Russian Federation soil. Because they saw Chernobyl as being something against the Ukrainians. So they said, now let's poison the land of the Russians.
Yeah, and I also, there was a lot of sort of that mysticism, historical thing, because of Kursk again. But I did hear about the nuclear power plant. But I mean, you're going to be back down there again, and you're going to have a whole another set of interviews to do, because things are not going well in Pokrovsk either.
Oh no!
It's funny that you're talking about Kursk. And he says, the same crews that destroyed our logistics in the Kursk direction last winter and spring are still operating. Oh, weird. They're doing that so well. He said, everything that we're seeing in Pokrovsk happened mostly due to the unmanned forces of the Russians who are blocking our logistics. Essentially, if it hadn't been for the Kursk region, the events we are witnessing today would have likely happened in Pokrovsk back in the spring. This is not glorifying the Kursk operation. These are simple facts. Same tactics, same crew, similar developments. Back then, all the best FPV drone operators were redeployed from various fronts to Suja, forming the Rubicon, a consolidation, whatever. This is all blah, 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 blah. But still, I thought it was interesting that the same crews that were fucking them up in Kursk are fucking them up again in Pokrovsk. And last I heard was 10,000 of them are stuck in that cauldron around Pokrovsk.
They're not only stuck in the cauldron. I mean, that cauldron is slowly, you know, it's tightening the noose there. I mean, they're going to be completely surrounded. Can you imagine that many POWs? It's going to be a huge tactical defeat for the Ukrainian regime. How are they going to even justify at that point? Continuing on, but did you see those images of the ceremony, the medal ceremony, the award ceremony?
Yeah.
So for those who were able to watch, I mean, there were so many funny memes going around and clips from Downfall when Hitler is outside of the bunker giving these medals to like 12-year-old kids who are like, I shot, you know, I destroyed two tanks. And he's like, I wish my generals were as good as you. And it felt like that there. The problem is that those units were all had SS patches in the Ukrainian regime's forces, the Azov guys. So I'm like, oh, not too far off. I mean, not too far off in terms of the analogy. We're right there, you know, follow your leader.
Well, speaking of the specter of communism, congratulations. I heard that you have retained your office in Vermont.
I've retained
your office, high bailiff. And apparently communism has taken over the New York City.
There it is.
I really love that graphic. I think it's adorable.
The fact that that's on the front page of like a national newspaper is unbelievable.
I really don't have much to say about Mamdani. I mean, other than meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Can I tell you, that picture has sunk him in more ways than you can. Okay, I don't like the guy, but let's see what happens. Once I saw that picture, I said it's over.
Yeah, done. I did not like the guy. Well, I like the guy. I don't like the platform. I don't like the policies at all. I hate this sort of milquetoast communism. And then, oh, I'm a democratic socialist. Just say you're a coward and leave us alone. Anyway, I don't like the. And after I saw that, I was like, well, I kind of knew because I had like the tinfoil hatters that were coming around and being like, no, you guys don't understand. He's actually backed by this, this, that, and the other thing. And then I saw the picture. I was like, okay. Here's Trump congratulating Mamdani. Just kidding. That's an actual terrorist. That's Jolani. Yeah. But here's Trump's reaction to Mamdani.
On November 5th, 2024, the American people reclaimed our government. We restored our sovereignty. We lost a little bit of sovereignty last night in New York, but we'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. We rescued our economy, regained our liberty, and together we saved our country.
A little bit of sovereignty last night in New York.
Can I just ask how you lose sovereignty by voting? Okay, maybe I don't like who people voted for, but how is that losing sovereignty? Isn't that what sovereignty is all about? I don't know. Words don't have any meaning anyway anymore. What does it even matter? Who cares about democracy? It's all a show anyway.
It's crazy. We lost a little bit of sovereignty last night. We'll get it back. What is this like game? Like,
we lost a little bit of sovereignty.
It's the same country. No. Who'd you lose sovereignty to?
You're literally controlled by Miriam Adelson. Give me a break about sovereignty.
Literally. And then the reaction, and this is the only reason why I'm talking about this, because this wraps right into what we talked about in the beginning, is that the reaction to this is, guys, we lost because of the infighting. We have got to stop fighting. And it's like, you guys have no idea why you lost. And the only person that's speaking any sense at all, is besides us that are screaming into the void, is Thomas Massie.
Yep.
Quit covering for pedophiles. Put America before Israel. Put farmers before corporations. Quit funding wars abroad. Reduce spending and quit attacking independent voices. But no, these idiots at the MAGA movement think that if they just stop fighting online, everything will be fine. And I don't know if you saw this, and I'm only going to touch on it a little bit because I didn't upload any graphics, but I might maybe do a space on it. But Laura Loomer, who is one of the rabid Zionists that's not, wasn't so Israel, like she didn't go to Israel a lot. She didn't meet with a lot of Israelis or anything like that. She was just Israel first. She traveled to Israel either on Monday or Tuesday. Within 8 hours of landing in Israel and her meeting, she had posted about some meetings. She posts that she has finally gotten her White House press pass. She is now part of the White House press corps. Okay. This is something that she's begged for years. Remember that. Also recall that the Pentagon wanted all of those reporters to sign NDAs and all kinds of crap. And they said no, and they walked out. So now they have the people that will say yes and will do all of their bidding. What happened after immediately following? Guys, I think I might have bookmarked the post, I hope. She posted another post that says, it's basically MAGA versus America First. And if you aren't America First, meaning that you are not like you're anti-Israel, she's coming after you from inside the White House.
Civil war.
I know. It's and these like these people are talking about fighting online. I'm like, yeah, you guys are fighting online, but the actual like the crazy people and the people with ambition are like making moves to get inside of the White House. Don't forget, guys, she got like a half dozen people fired on the spot.
She did. She did. She's notorious.
Right following that, an article comes out in the New York Times that says, of the people who are under 30 in the Trump administration, 40% of them are groypers. I hear a purge coming.
Purge.
I hear a purge coming. Who, if you don't align with the Israel first or the Zionist foreign policy or whatever, you're automatically a groyper or a Nazi or America first and not MAGA. So there's your answer to all of that.
It's happening, isn't it?
Not to mention, Trump did a, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black last night. He said any Jew that votes for this, the Mamdani self-professed Jew hater, like, it's just, it's insane.
It's like the meme, you know, let them fight. But the problem is that we're all going to bear the consequences.
We are going to bear the consequences because it's going to affect policy. And I actually don't want MAGA to win. I think MAGA represents this sort of neocons. The neocons didn't have anywhere to go. They really didn't, because the grand old GOP is kind of defunct. Nobody wants to talk to freaking what's his face, Josh Hawthorne or whatever his name is. What's that guy's name? The guy from Missouri.
Josh Hawley.
Hawley. Yeah, there it is. Nobody wants to talk to the actual grand old GOP. So the GOP and the neocons have latched onto this MAGA thing, and the more to the right people have gotten into this America First movement, which means we place America before Israel. That's where we're at in America right now. That's the civil war, whether it will play out online or actually in policy or in the White House or on the streets. Who the hell knows? But, oh, and then obviously Trump did crash out. So, but we have a government shutdown.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm trying to give MAGA the benefit of the doubt, but this is a mess.
It's an absolute mess. By the way, as people rightfully are pointing out, Dick Cheney did die.
He did die. I was going to do a tribute to him, but I didn't want to make the producer do work for Dick Cheney. So let's all just take a moment of silence and hope that Dick Cheney is burning in hell, tormented by the souls of millions of Iraqis, Afghans, Iranians, anybody's lives he destroyed. Please torment him for all of eternity. I really have no words to say about Dick fucking shoot my friend in the face Cheney.
Yep. You know, I mean, him and Madeleine Albright, you know, that whole crew.
It was worth it.
It was worth it. Was the cost worth it? It was worth it. I mean, who says something like that? But that's why they're friends with the Ukrainian fascists and all these other fucking head choppers. And that's, you know, they train them, you know, so there you go.
Maybe I'll do a segment on it on Sunday. Thanks to a good friend of the show and some research, found out that for years that Nigeria has been complaining that fighters and weapons from Ukraine have been ending up in the hands of the terrorists who are killing the Christians. That everybody's
interesting. At the same time, the Ukrainian government is destroying the Orthodox Church there.
Yeah, it's wild how that's working. Literally, you guys can look on Twitter today. It might have been posted last night, but today there is a video running around of Ukrainian forces and what looks like a Colombian mercenary barging into an Orthodox Church, but nobody says shit. But God forbid the 50 Christians that died in the last 3 months in Nigeria, but nobody says shit about what's going on in Ukraine. Very nice selective outrage, Zionists. Don't worry, I'm coming for you.
Of course not.
All right, let's get through these super chats. Thank you, Joseph, as always. Thank you, Hummus, and congrats on 1 month with us. It's our anniversary. I started that for myself, for my own ego. And thank you. Thank you very much, Will.
Thank you.
We'll let Chris go to bed and we'll be back on Sunday.
No, I have to go on RT now. That's
Well, Chris, go to RT and we will see you guys on Sunday. Go to ddgeopolitics.com and buy clothes. Love
Take
you guys.
Take care, everyone. Good Bye. To see you all.